Welcome to another exciting episode of the NIDS View, a weekly show of the National Institute for Deterrence Studies, where we are advancing peace, promoting stability, and helping you to think deterrence. Each week, we will discuss and analyze a recent topic and provide insight to how it affects our national deterrence. The view of the hosts and guests are their own. We hope you enjoy the show.
Welcome, welcome to another edition of the NIDS View. I'm Curtis McGiffin. I'm your host today. And no, Adam is not away on assignment. He's actually here, and he's going to be the talent today, along with Jim Petrosky. And today is News Roundup Day. Who has no talent. And today is News Roundup Day. We do these occasionally when I get to host, you know, between you, me, and, you know, because there's really just a couple of us out there who are listening to this show. You know, Adam was supposed to be at a function. A function ended, and he rushed over and said, I got to be a part of this. So here we are. So this is going to be great. And we're going to go through a couple of great news articles from the month of March 2025 that I find interesting. And that's why we pick them. And so we'll kind of run through these and we'll get some thoughts and comments from our esteemed crew here. So without any further ado, we'll go ahead and get started. So gentlemen, welcome. Good to see you all. I want to start off today with an article that came out in came out on March 18th from Air and Space Magazine online by John Turpik, saying that the STRATCOM chief, Air Force needs 145 B-21s and more new strategic systems. So I thought this was an interesting piece. General Cotton, the commander of U.S. Strategic Command, has come out publicly stating that we need 145 stealth B-21 bombers to cope with the increased threats to U.S. security. And which has basically changed since the program came into being. And along with that, he stresses that we've got to ensure that we pay attention to the buildup of the long-range standoff weapons, the new cruise missiles that would go into these bombers, and the modernization of the B-52J model, which includes engines and avionics and some other systems. And I guess with the total, that would be about 220 bombers in the inventory going forward. This assumes the B-1s and the B-2s are all retired. He also goes on to say that, hey, the Air Force plans to buy 1,087 LRSOs, of which 67 are planned to be used for testing. So that's 1,020 that would be operational. These would be nuclear-tipped cruise missiles. And this figure was the selection back in 2010. When the world was much safer and peaceful. And I guess there's some suggestion here that we might need to consider more of them, especially considering that the Russians and the Chinese are just going crazy with the development of hypersonic systems, their LACMs, land attack cruise missiles development, and their air-launched ballistic missiles, which, by the way, we don't have any plans to build any. So I wanted to point this article out because you know, there's been a lot of speculation about B-21s, Adam. And we had a podcast recently where we kind of talked about this. Bob Peters from Heritage was saying we should up the production rates and these sorts of things. There's been lots of speculation from different think tanks about how many there should be. But it's 100 that's the program of record right now. And this is the first time that we've seen some definitive number of what we think we really need at 145. What are your thoughts on that?
So 145 is a good number if President Trump is able to negotiate away the strategic threats posed by the Russians and the Chinese, because I want at least 300. So if President Trump can do that and he promised to cut defense expenditures in half, then I will settle for 145 only. But, you know, General Cotton said, at least 145.
Yeah.
So this is not an upper limit. This is a you know, this is the floor, not the ceiling. Because the simple fact is, you know, we are going to have, assuming nothing changes, let's presume that President Trump is not able to make a deal with the Russians and the Chinese. Maybe he settles Ukraine and that sort of works itself out. But that doesn't solve all the other threats, the Iranians, you know, the North Koreans. China may not give up on taking Taiwan, and hopefully we're not willing to sell it or sell it out. So, sell it? You know, so let's presume none of that happens. And so we don't make a deal. 145 is sort of the lower end, because one of the things, you know, people don't seem to think about, it's, you know, it's the funny thing about nuclear weapons and strategic systems versus, you know, small arms rounds or, you know, tanks or anything else. You need more than the absolute minimum number of 100% hit to kill. Right. So right. There's a presumption that if I got 1,000 targets, I only need 1,000 weapons or, you know, I just need enough airplanes to hit those specific targets. But in reality, we know, especially right now, one of the problems is we only have two effective legs of the triad: ICBMs, which are on alert 24/7, 365, and then a portion of the submarine force, which is always on alert. And then bombers are basically sitting in, you know, shelters that are not hardened. You know, they can be attacked by conventional weapons. And really all you've got to do, I mean, to take the bomber force out, you need to take out the weapons storage area at Whiteman Air Force Base and at Minot Air Force Base. And then the bombers aren't a problem. So the idea that we need additional bombers, additional crews, the maintenance, the, you know, all the cops to protect them, and another weapon storage area at Barksdale, which hopefully we're going to get. Weapon storage facility is what we're going to call it now. We need to get all these things, and then we need to put bombers on alert. And then we might actually have three legs of a triad. So I'm glad, you know, General Cotton said at least 145. That's a great start. And so, yeah, absolutely.
Well, my sense is he's going to carry that message to the whatever Armed Services Committee that he's going to be speaking to here in the near future. I think last year it was written in the article that he was asked about it, and he said, I would love to have more bombers. That was the definitive number at that point.
Yeah.
So there you go. Jim, what are your thoughts here? You know, we know that the B-21's got a smaller bomb capacity than the B-2 or the B-1. While it brings a lot of other capability, including the ability to engage with the LRSO, it is going to be, if the idea is we need more bombers for the conventional mission, I mean, it's just not going to be able to drop as many bombs to do that. So I'm kind of interested, I don't know, what, you know, how about that? Are we really, is 145 in your opinion going to be enough? Is that the right number?
Hey, before you say something, Jim.
Uh-oh, here we go.
Let me just also add that LRSO is the, you know, it's the nuclear modernization program that is on target. It's on time. It's on budget. It's sort of our, you know, the best one we have. And so this is really, you know, it's actually good news, because the B-21 seems to be, for the most part, on time. And then the weapon, you know, that it will field will be on time as well. So that's good news.
Right.
Okay. So thanks for letting me talk here, Curtis. I didn't realize we didn't really do the normal show prep because Adam came in late. So he stole my thunder, and you read the article to everyone. So essentially, my answer is we need 146. I'm going to. Anyway, and then
you're
going to
win the showcase showdown.
And then when we get 146, I think we need probably 147. But Adam did steal a little bit of my thunder here. So I'm going to take back and say this the importance here is not only we need more bombers, but we need the crews and all the support mechanisms that go with it. And it's really important to see it that way, because that's you can produce things. And, you know, if we were wartime, we'd be, you know, pooping these things out left and right. We'd have to. Okay. But we're not. So we go the slow route. You know, every time you go to war, you start, you know, moving things rather quickly, but you can't just create pilots. You can't just create, you know, instantaneously these people. And that's the issue that I see is important here that I'd like to see more on. The other piece is, if we have not 145, but 146 B-21s, how does the strategy change? And you sort of alluded to it there with where's that conventional piece? Where's the nuclear piece? How's that divided out? And how is it managed, or if you will, dynamically changed so that the conventional mission is met, but when we need the nuclear mission, we can slowly or very quickly roll into that. And that's why I see the LRSO is an extremely important component to this, because that's the way you take these bombers that may have a conventional mission, but may be able to add in the mix of the nuclear to be able to be part of the deterrent. And then the last piece I'm just going to throw out there again, I've thrown it there multiple times. If we would put bombers on alert, those 145 would be a great messaging system and a great training opportunity for all those new pilots and navigators and maintenance people to be out there taking care of those aircraft instead of maintaining the building and everything else around it. Let's take care of the thing that's actually going to do the job. So that's my two cents when I read this article.
I gotcha. Now, and I just make mention here, he also called for the idea that we need more Columbia-class submarines than what is currently programmed. So I'm sure the Navy really enjoyed hearing that call. And, of course, there's still concerns with the Sentinel, but we must have them. And so, you know, good for General Cotton. He's getting out there in front of this.
I'm glad.
And putting some pressure on Congress. We're living in dangerous times. We've got to have the capability to deal with it. Okay, well, let's move on to the next article that I found interesting.
You know the great thing about General Cotton's comments is he's looking a lot more like Admiral Richards these days.
He is looking a lot, sounding a lot more anyway. but most definitely, you know, when you sit in that job, you get hardened and you realize we really can't continue to just sort of whistle past the graveyard here. We gotta get moving. Okay. So the next article that I wanted to point out that some of our listeners may not be familiar with also came out on March 18th, and it's on Real Clear Defense by Ji-Hoon Yu, Strategic Implications of North Korea's Nuclear Submarine Development. So there's been some pictures that have come out of this giant submarine that the North Koreans are building. It's rumored to be nuclear powered. Some people are questioning that. It could be an issue with maybe they're getting some of that Russian technology, payback for the 14 or 15,000 North Korean troops they sent to Ukraine. But the idea here that the North Koreans, the author keeps talking about, well, this is a guaranteed sort of retaliation, second strike, survivable second strike for the North Koreans. I highly doubt that's the way Kim Jong-un might see the use of this stealthy boat that can float closer to the U.S. and hold our cities at risk for a potential first strike, or at least a threatened coercive maneuver. And what this does is, if this thing really is out there, we've got to spend resources to find it and then track it. And then if that capability is out there, it really takes preemptive measures by the U.S. off the table. It becomes much more difficult to launch a preemptive strike when you've got real capability to threaten American cities on the East Coast, much less the West Coast. And so these are real challenges. So, Jim, I want to go to you first on this, because this is largely an engineering question. I mean, can they do this? Is this something that they're at the position or mature enough technologically and engineering wise to really build a submarine like this? And if not, can there really be a diesel powered submarine big enough to carry what is estimated to be maybe up to 10 ICBMs or SLBMs in this boat? What are your thoughts there?
Well, the last time I worked with North Korean engineers, never. So thanks for passing it to me that way. So let me do it a different way. I'm gonna look at this and actually Adam's our naval guy. So I think he's gonna be able to talk a little bit with a little more authority than I will on that piece. But when I read this article initially, and I said, okay, let's look at it in a worst case scenario, and then think about it from a realistic standpoint. If you look at it in a worst case scenario, it, you know, pardon me, but it scared the hell out of me. If we're doing, if this really is going to be a nuclear powered submarine that can be used in some attack mode, in some aggressive mode with nuclear tipped missiles, ballistic missiles. And that does, as you said, present a very short warning attack methodology for North Korea that they have not had, not only for the U.S., of course, but for the many other people that they, you know, try to threaten, the Japanese, the South Koreans. You know, this really adds to the to their portfolio of capability. But the other thing that I question, and this is where I do pass it on to Adam, because the one question you have is, it's a nuclear-powered submarine. Okay. But the one thing about the submarines that I've learned about is that they carry a boatload, pun intended, underwater boatload of technology. I mean, our submarines, even the Russian submarines, are full of technology that lets them be stealthy, that lets them know where they are, brings about incredible accuracy and capability to do deep water and not have to do as much shallow water work, where they're able to be sensed, they're able to communicate very well and operate independently, and quite resilient to many of the effects that you would have in warfare. And so the real question about the development of this is, how much of that technology goes into this brand new boat that's going to hit the ground and, or hit the water, shall I say, hit the water. And how much of that technology is truly resilient, high quality. You know, if you shoot ballistic missiles and they miss by very long distances, or don't, you know, fire out of the water at all, which is, by the way, a very tricky problem, to do that in a very secure but a very robust way, this becomes a problem. And so there's very little in this article about that. And I'd be curious what Adam thinks in terms of the way that technology and the way that comes about. Because, as I said at the very beginning, I've never really worked with North Korean engineers, but I have seen some of their, work, and I haven't seen a lot of great technology improvements coming out of North Korea in terms of what they do. They stick to the, sort of like Russia. They stick to the efficient bread and butter kinds of warfare tactics and warfare capabilities. Now, I could be wrong. Let's hear what Adam has to say. Yeah.
Well, what I would say here before I pass it over to Adam is that the North Koreans, for whatever they are not afraid to innovate, test, and learn from their failures. And I think given enough time and enough Russian help, they'll get there. So I'll go to Adam here. And Adam, I'm going to ask you, is this a real strategic game changer? And what does this do to a potential arms race in the in that region with a ballistic submarine?
So if they can actually build that, and I do think you're right that it's going to require significant Russian help, because getting a ICBM out of a tube into the air, the rocket kicks in at the right time. It's a complicated process, right? We figured it out in the 1950s, but we're special, right? God loves us more, so that's why we were able to do it. I mean, I guess the Russians could say that too, because I think they actually did it first, but they don't believe in God, so that's out of the question. So, but you know, it's a complicated question that I don't. First of all, it wouldn't be very quiet, right? The Russians are not going to give them their best quieting technology, which they stole from us, of course, but they're not going to give them that. And so what I was really thinking in terms of what this could mean is that this is an opportunity for the ROKs, the South Koreans, to even the score on the sinking of the Chonan. If it were me, before this boat ever gets its reactor and before it ever leaves port, I would go, I would sink it. I think there, and it's not an act of war, because look at all of the things that the North Koreans have done. They've dug tunnels and put troops in them to invade. They violated the border. They've killed American officers. I think I counted, whenever I was at the DMZ, they had a list, and it was like 80 incidents. You know, they're shelling South Korean islands and killing South Korean citizens. They sink a war vessel. So obviously, if the rocks were to go and sink this vessel, that would not be an act of war any more than any of the North Koreans' 80 provocations were an act of war. But I think it would finally send a message that the rock is you know, there are limits. And to me, this is a great time and place to send that message that you will not have the sea is not yours, and sink it, because you don't need to use a nuclear weapon to sink a nuclear submarine.
Oh, definitely not. I think the author seems to imply in his article that this would largely stay in the region and be more of a threat to Japan and others. I don't believe that. I think that if they're going to go to the level of building this submarine, their intention is to float it out there in the deep blue sea and hold America at risk. Well,
the Chinese don't, you know, the Chinese have been at this much longer. And right. Even with their Gen class boats, they don't do like 90-day deterrent patrols. Because sure. they don't trust them. The Chinese lost a boat here recently, and you know, they lost a crew. So even with a country that's been doing this a while, like the Chinese, they have limits. So that could potentially be the case, you know, especially if you only got one. And our attack submarines are pretty good, especially with noisy boats. So I'm not sure this would be a good idea for the North Koreans.
Well, as an aside note, I think the Indians just added their second boomer as well to their sea triad. So, I mean, this seems to be another proliferating technology, however you want to couch it, on the North Korean side.
Proliferation? Oh, no.
But I wanted to say, but I thought this piece was interesting, and I wanted to make sure we had a moment to talk about it. So let's jump over to the next article. So we're going to jump over to Europe. This article was an AP article that came out on the 13th of March President Duda calls on U.S. to place nuclear weapons in Poland. President Duda, obviously the president of Poland, has been very vocal about securing Poland. You know, he lives in a rough neighborhood. He borders Ukraine, Belarus, Kaliningrad, the Baltics area, all of that. Of course, you know, and the Germans, and you know, all that, if you want to reach back into your history. And so he's very concerned, and he wants to have a nuclear capability. And of course, they're one of these, they're in the 5%er club, right? They're doing 5% of their GDP in their NATO contributions. There's no question that Poland has come to play with regard to their NATO commitments and ensuring their sovereignty. They've lived under the boot of Soviet communism, and they don't intend to ever do that again. So there's this interest in doing that, and actually asking for America to sort of to move some of those lower yield nuclear bombs, the B-61s that we have in the European theater, and maybe put them there to sort of offset what the Russians did recently by moving low yield tactical weapons into Belarus, and continue to message. And in lieu of that, you know, how do we, you know, can that be? They know that they would take years to draw their own nukes. So let me ask. Let me go to Jim Petrowski, our resident Polish ancestor, for his thoughts on whether or not.
Doesn't Jim, don't you feel more comfortable when I address you as Comrade Jim?
Comrade Jim. Comrade Petrowski. Right. Let us know what your thoughts are on this there.
So my first comment is pretty straightforward on this, and that is, you know, we need to get the the non-proliferation disarmament people over into Poland real quickly. I can't believe they're actually wanting to have nuclear weapons in their country to do something there. Didn't they know they're dangerous and horrible for the entire world? I mean, this is just an incredible new thing that's happening. But in all seriousness, it shows the value of nuclear weapons in the strategic and global security realm as we continue to operate in what is a horrible neighborhood that they're sitting in. And the Poles, you know, they're in an interesting strategic position right now because they are right on the border of where, you know, war is occurring against an aggressor who is willing to use, and I say use two ways. One, at least has demonstrated the willingness to use the weapons in an aggressive way by saying, we'll attack you, you know, just back off. But we haven't seen the use of the employment versus a deployment of nuclear weapons, but the deployment's there. And I believe the will is there from Russia to use them. And that suddenly makes the Poles feel as though they are threatened. And that threat from a nuclear weapon is real. And everyone knows that deterrence in the nuclear weapon realm comes from nuclear weapon retaliation and or security. So I think this is an interesting thing for our non-proliferation people to look to. Because, you know, maybe Poland is able to handle their own weapons, or as they've done, I think we're going to talk a little bit about that later on, the Germans have, and the French, you know, they're both have mentioned in Europe that they are willing to provide a nuclear umbrella to Poland and to support Europe because they feel threatened as well. So, you know, all those jokes aside that you guys gave me in the prep that I'm going to leave off the table for now.
No jokes.
But all jokes aside, I mean, you look at their strategic position and where Russia is. Really matters.
So, well, Duda says in this article, quote, I think it's not only that the time has come, but it would be safer if those weapons were already here. So the Poles clearly have an affinity or an understanding that nuclear weapons equal safety, sovereignty, protection, and not the opposite of what you sort of talked about with the potential protesters, right? That they would say, well, this is dangerous, so we shouldn't have these weapons here because they might, you know, just blow up on their own and we've got to deal with the consequences. And so, you know, these are some of those kinds of challenges. But in lieu of moving American weapons, if you will, to Poland, there has been a lot of whisper about, Macron has been quite vocal about offering French nuclear weapons as a deterrent for Europe. It was an article that came out in the Wall Street Journal by Nomi Bizerby, I'm sorry if I mispronounced the name, on the 18th of March. Macron touts France's nuclear arsenal as allies look beyond the U.S. umbrella. So Macron says they have plans to spend $1.6 billion to modernize several of the facilities that they use for their advanced Rafale jets that carry their nuclear weapons, and that the jets will carry next-generation hypersonic missiles equipped with nuclear warheads. Okay, so this is the first time I've heard this, that there's a plan by the French to build hypersonic weapons that are nuclear armed. The previous administration, the Biden administration, basically said they were not going to do that, that the Americans will not do that. But it seems to be acceptable by our French allies who are more than willing to at least talk about sharing their nukes with the European Union, which is interesting because they're not really interested in sharing it with NATO. And I would ask, as I go over here to get your thoughts on this, Adam, is this now going – we're going to have to change the song to 33 Luftballons because they're only one-third our size?
Oh, man. It's You know what? What sort of struck me about this is I've wondered. So France has a GDP 1/10 that of the United States. And yet France is modernizing and expanding its nuclear arsenal. But yet in this country, the nuclear modernization is it's cost too much for us to do it, and we have to cancel it because it'll break the bank. So I'm sort of curious how a country 1/10 as wealthy as we are can afford it, or a country like North Korea can afford it, or anybody else has a much smaller economy. But somehow we, the Americans, can't seem to afford it. That's one of the things. I know it's not on topic, but it's one of the things that sort of struck me about this. Now, wouldn't this be just desserts for, for the French to, they've lost a couple of wars against the Germans. And so now to have French nuclear weapons in Germany, that would be
unexploded, nonetheless.
Exactly. would be so. I mean, if I were French, I would be like, let's absolutely make this happen. This will be
just for bragging rights. I mean, the incoming odds-on favorite for the new German chancellor, Friedrich Merz, has basically called on France to share their weapons. And the idea now that they're going to, instead of, being, under the decision process of Washington, D.C., they're going to be under the decision process of Paris. Because in all of this, in no way does Macron ever plan to cede decision-making on the use of French nuclear weapons on behalf of Germany or Poland or Brussels or anyone else.
And how are they going to overcome that?
Yeah.
Let's keep in mind as we contemplate Polish nuclear participation.
Yes, right.
Yay.
That the East European plain where the Poles live is, one of the few flats. It's a flat space before Russia. It's a perfect fighting ground if you're Russian and don't want the Europeans in your country. And thus, they've been partitioned twice by the Russians and the Germans and others. So the Poles are very motivated to protect themselves, and rightfully so, by the way.
Yes. Hey, I want to throw a couple of quick things in here, though, and that is that we wouldn't have to worry about moving nuclear weapons into Poland if we already had them there. Again, hindsight is, 2020, and so that's the first piece. The second piece is if the French do develop these nuclear hypersonic weapons, I think that is a great advancement, and certainly something that we need to look at strategically and how that affects that entire region, because that gives a new capability, again, in the region for France to protect itself. I thought reading that, I was just amazed at it. Although I would say you don't want to call it the Maginot Line. You got to come up with something better. and then the other one is, of course, is the last piece in tongue in cheek is, what a name, Duda. I wished my name was Duda instead of Petrosky, over Macron. I mean, I'm the Duda. So, we're going to do it. Okay. So I just thought I'd pass that on. All right.
Well, let me, as we wrap things up here, because we're starting to run out of drive time, I wanted to just quote the last paragraph in this Wall Street Journal article that says, France's nuclear doctrine is based around strategic ambiguity, stating the president can order a strike to protect the country's vital interests, quote unquote, without defining any clear red lines. France's vital interests have always had a European dimension. And so that's how they're sort of coupling this together. But what I find interesting is that I've always been the one who's said that when the world decides to disarm, it will be the French who will be the last, not the Russians, not the Chinese. The Brits will be first, and then maybe the Americans. But the point here is that it will be the French that will do it last. I mean, no one's been invaded more than France, other than, say, Russia. And
the Poles.
Okay, I'll buy that. But they don't have them yet. And so my figure is that there's this, I think, this irrational fear that that the United States is going to leave NATO. It's not. I don't care who's president. But I do. And it says in this article that they are undergoing a trillion euro rearmament plan. Right. And there was some talk about that. I didn't pick that article, but there was some recently I guess she's the president of the EU. I guess they have their own president. And she sort of laid out. I forgot her name. I apologize. She sort of laid out a plan. It's all very good. These are all things that President Trump wants. His point is that if you pay your fair share, America will be there for you. And yet they're saying, well, we're going to have to pay our fair share because the Americans are going to leave. No, if you pay your fair share, the Americans are not going to leave. So what I just want to caution the Europeans is to don't talk yourselves out of an American relationship. I mean, you know, you keep beating this drum unnecessarily, and all you're doing is spending the money that we want you to spend anyway to pay your fair share, quote unquote. Now, this looks like a massive rearmament to Russian eyes. And so there needs to be some messaging. But at the same time, they have to be careful about what Europe does in regard to that. You know, there was an article that also came out this month that said that in 2024, the Europeans paid more to Russia to buy their energy than they gave to Ukraine to fight the war. So they're essentially funding both sides of this war out of whatever necessity that they feel. And so we have to understand that when we think about national interests and peace and how we're going to work with maintaining this stability, trading with your principal adversary may not necessarily be the best strategic decision. I've been one of those who's been crowing about that for a while. We do it with China. It's a big problem. I think with the Soviet Union, our trade was at 4%, I mean, terribly small and mostly, you know, life-saving wheat and those sorts of things to prevent people from starving to death, because Americans are good people and, you know, we don't want to see people starve. So, okay. Hey, I appreciate it. You all going over these four pieces with me. Let me go. Adam, any final thoughts?
You know, hopefully here in Kansas City, we're about to get a blizzard. So hopefully it's not too bad.
Okay, that's
I'm thinking about the weather. I mean, when you live in the Midwest,
Adam's
you think
national
about the
interest.
Weather.
Making sure he can get dinner tonight. All right, very good. Yeah. Appreciate you. Jim, any final thoughts as we wrap things up?
No, we have been hitting on some of these other topics, though, in our HUSI seminars, as well as, you know, continuing and looking at the world writ large through our Deterrence Down Under podcast. So I suggest to our listeners to, you know, go out and listen to those. They give you a more rounded view. I think the view, the NIDS view, which is where you are right now, sort of pulls that all together. So that's good. And then last, I want to just thank our donors and our listeners both. I'll pass it back to you, Curtis, to end us out.
All right. Well, thank you. One last programming note. In the month of March, we had a HUSI event that you can find on YouTube and Rumble and in other places where we had Gordon Chang and Rick Fisher. It is must-see
awesome.
TV. I highly recommend you search that up. It's a quick hour, but you will learn so much and probably not sleep well that night with regard to the Chinese threat. So I really highly encourage our listeners to go find that. In the meantime, please continue to check us out on our website at thinkdeterrence.com. Follow us on X, Twitter X at thinkdeterrence. Hit us up on LinkedIn. Send us an email. Love show ideas, topic ideas. You never know. You might get invited to join us. And keep listening. We want to thank you. We had a recent Deterrence Down Under is now on video. You can see the lovely ladies from Australia on YouTube. And you can Real Space Strategy just had a live event. So that will be up posted here very soon. So I do highly encourage. There's a lot going on here at the National Institute for Deterrent Studies. It will keep you pretty busy and well-informed. So again, I want to thank you all and remind you to always think deterrence.
Thank you for listening to the NIDS View. This show is produced under the NIDS Podcasting Network, a division of the National Institute for Deterrence Studies. NIDS is a 501c3 organization dependent upon donations to provide this podcast and bring about awareness of the peacekeeping value of U.S. strength and our national deterrence. You can catch all of our podcasts or provide feedback at thinkdeterrence.com. I would like to thank our producer, Kimberly Charrington, our sponsors, and all the fantastic members of the National Institute for Deterrence Studies for making this podcast possible. Stay tuned next week for another exciting and informative The NIDS View.
The NIDS Podcasting Network.